Over the low-lying fields, over the wide meadows, the sun, rampant, galloping westward, beating back the night.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with writer Joe Mino. His novel, Marvel and a Wonder, is set in the summer of 1995. Jim Falls, a grandfather, sets out alone to raise his grandson, Quentin.
The land itself, shadow quiet, blue, blurred by fog, on and on towards Apiothis, the sun rising higher in the sky, interrupting a faint-hued dark.
Marvel, Wonder, and Surprise, with novelist Joe Mino on Arts and Letters.
Busted and braided, weathered and alone. The soul of a cowboy is still.
On that Sunday in July 1995, The grandfather woke early thinking of the boy. He placed his 2 feet on the bare floor and stood, his limbs giving some dispute before dressing in the near darkness.
Happiness is simple, happiness is free.
He made his ablutions in the bathroom and then bared his teeth in the mirror. Lean-faced, tall, thinning, white-haired, Jim Falls, age 71.
Just watch the Appaloosa and follow their lead. Gallop to the border where dreams come alive.
He walked down the short hallway to find the boy was once again not in bed. He took in the odd odor of the boys' quarters, dirty gym socks, exotic pets, and rubber cement, but could not make out the smell of sleep. He glanced around the room in silent despair and then closed the door behind him.
Gallop to the border.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Menick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today we'll be talking with Joe Mino, author of Marvel and a Wonder, published by Akashic Books. His novel is firmly ensconced in place and reveals the wonderment of possibility, which is looming just beyond the next hill and the next.
Jim went downstairs and put on his white cattleman hat and boots, then walked outside half a dozen paces to the hen house, where he found the boy Quentin asleep beside a pile of comic books. The boy's Walkman was still playing.
They plucked me straight from the dirt.
His eyeglasses folded near his face. At the boy's feet was a backpack crammed with clothes and junk food. A map and other odds and ends. Jim leaned over and switched the tape player off, then nudged his grandson awake with the toe of his boot. It was 5:30. The sun had been up for 12 minutes already, but none of the birds made a sound. The boy startled, wiped a silver streak of drool from his chin, then put on his glasses. Though he was only 16, he was only a fraction of that in sensibility, closer to a child in both manner and maturity. The boy's face rounded, olive-complected, appeared even darker in the shadows of the henhouse. Lying there, he looked like a bairn, like some strange nursling.
Joe Mino, fiction writer, playwright, professor. Welcome.
Oh, thanks so much, Brad, for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
So it's said that much of what is done in a first chapter sets up and determines the rest of the novel, and I think that statement is apt when applied to this one. In Marvel and a Wonder, the first part of the novel, it seems to me quite a microcosm for the rest of the book.
The first chapter is always the last one that gets written after you've spent some time figuring out the rest of the book, and then you go back, and you really are trying to provide a kind of keystone for people to unlock and appreciate the rest of the book. So this book is about a grandfather, Jim, and his grandson, Quentin, and their relationship, and they're separated by two generations, and their relationship is fraught because of the distance in their age and distance in culture. Jim's a former Korean war vet, and Quentin is a 16-year-old boy who's mixed race, who's grown up in this small town in Indiana and feels outside of any other connections with the other kids in town, with his own mother. And so the conflict of the story is really about that distance between these two characters, these two men who desperately love each other but have almost no way to express that love. And that distance is also built in the physical landscape of the story itself. So it takes place in a small town in southern Indiana, and so much of the conflict and drama comes from that place itself.
The kind of miniature that you create here in the beginning about the idea of what the grandfather sees as the reality of just animals on the farm and the fate of some of these animals, he sees them as real utilitarian.
After an hour, the grandfather and grandson had finished candling the eggs and began counting peeps, carrying the newly hatched peeps over the brooder, a circular pen made of corrugated cardboard with three heat lamps hanging directly above it. The boy handed a peep to his grandfather, who studied it for a moment and then carefully set the animal inside the pen, dipping its beak into a pan of water, getting it acquainted with the trowel, and then let it run free.
You started working through the perspective particularly of Jim, and although this is told not completely from his point of view, there's a sense of his point of view in it.
You know, Brad, I was fortunate enough to spend a lot of time with my wife's stepfather, who grew up in a small town, grew up on a chicken farm in Indiana, and then at the age of 18 went off to serve in the Vietnam War, came back, hitchhiked all over America, and worked for the Department of Streets and Sanitation in a small town in Indiana. Anytime something broke in our house or anytime I had to do any kind of physical project, he was always the guy that I called first. And he was the most reliable, giving, thoughtful person. And at the same time, harbored these really, I think, kind of regressive ideas about race and about class. And so he had passed away a few years ago while I was in the middle of writing the book, actually. And I wanted to capture something about a person who could be so kind, so selfless, but also so misguided as it comes to things like race. The boy, overweight, with his soft, smooth cheeks that had yet to know the sting of a razor, and his glasses, the round frames of which made the chubbiness of the boy's head even more exaggerated, searched out the frailest-looking peep among them and found one with an inflamed, distended stomach. He knelt down beside the unlucky creature and closely inspected it, its shape reflected in his oversized glasses.
Sir? This one looks like it's got mushy chick.
You're right. Go on and put him in the other brooder. We don't need them other ones to get it, too.
And so he had passed away a few years ago while I was in the middle of writing the book, actually. And I wanted to capture something about a person who could be so kind, so selfless, but also so misguided as it comes to things like race in America. And so it definitely came out of my relationship with him. And so the book's dedicated to him and trying to capture the complexity of loving somebody who's deeply, deeply flawed, acknowledging those flaws and trying to find a way to move on from those kind of backwards ideas about race and in America. And so much of the grandfather is informed by my relationship with my wife's stepdad. The grandfather watched the boy out of the corner of his eye, seeing his grandson making small kissy faces at the sickly animal. The boy was now talking to the sick peep, nuzzling it against his chin.
All right, go on and leave that one alone. You can come back and visit with him when we're all done.
If he dies, I'm never going to church again.
What?
If he dies, then that's it for me and Jesus.
Well, I guess you can worry about that later.
Kneeling there in the saw-dusted coop, Jim took a hard look at the boy's face, searching for some resemblance to himself, something in the character of the boy's nose, ears, or lips, an activity that always left him with an unquestionable feeling of aggravation. There was nothing in the boy that looked like him.
Once I thought of no one but me, what I wanted is all I could see. Then I met my Savior at the cross on Calvary. He took my sin, changed my heart, and set me free.
And it's also intergenerational in the sense that Jim is firmly ensconced in the 20th century, and Quinn in the 21st.
Exactly, right. And you feel that in so much, whether you look at it politically, you look at it culturally, you feel like the country's suffering from that distance right now. And the idea, which I don't necessarily agree with, that distance is irreconcilable, that somehow because you live here and I live here, or this is the kind of music you like, or these are the kind of films you like, that we can't find some common ground or some points of connection. And really the book is about the necessity for these different sides to find common ground and to go back to this really elemental idea of sacrifice, that there are things worth sacrificing for, things worth giving up other things for in order to find those moments of connection. And so that's a mythical Old Testament kind of idea. So there's nothing new in I think that. But I think it's really important, especially at this moment.
Sir? Do you believe it's possible for a human being to talk to an animal?
We talk to chickens all day.
No, not tame ones, wild ones. Like in the movies, like in cartoons, so they can understand you.
I don't know if I can say I ever thought about it.
I can do it.
You can?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I can. I can talk to animals and some trees. It's because I have developed a new way of using my ears. I can hear things most other mortals cannot.
Quentin?
Sir?
Do you ever have a thought you keep to yourself?
I don't know. I don't think so. Why?
You might want to think about trying that sometime.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with Joe Mino about his book, Marvel and a Wonder. We'll be back in a moment. Let's return to our discussion with novelist Joe Mino, as he talks about his character, Jim Falls, a grandfather, and his relationship with his grandson, Quentin.
Both Jim, who's 71 years old, and Quentin, who's 16, are somewhat flawed. Jim's more flawed, I think, because he has more time to be flawed. He suffers from some racist tendencies. He's been damaged in the Korean War. But at the same time, he's kind of this strong, silent farmer who's trying to make ends meet. His daughter has had enough of him, and his daughter is kind of AWOL for 90% of the book. And Quentin is this kid with glasses who is perpetually damaged and hurt by his mother, but also, you know, has his own problems. He huffs a lot of glue and is trying to escape from this world that he just can't seem to understand.
When do you know?
They found the boy's mother, Deirdre, Jim's daughter and only offspring, asleep at the wheel of a rusty foreign model hatchback. You know, he feels completely alone in this world, other than his complicated relationship with his grandfather and his mother is absent because of her dependence on methamphetamines. She was passed out with an empty bottle of someone else's painkiller medication spilling out of her purse. When the grandfather shook her awake, she looked up and smiled like a child, though she was 37. her eyes opaque and unnaturally lovely. These the symptoms of her ongoing dependence on pain pills and methamphetamines. And so he feels completely alone. The only thing he has is his relationship with the animals on this small farm. And even that is conflictual. You know, his grandfather wants him to take care of these chickens, which they're raising for their livelihood, and he'd rather kind of keep them as pets. By evening, their chores have been done and their dinner eaten. In the dark, the boy wandered around outside searching for insects to feed his reptiles. He found a pill bug and dropped it into a glass jar. He looked up and heard the sound of a cricket, then followed it into the henhouse. There inside the brooder, the boy discovered the peep with the mushy chick had died. The boy called out for his grandfather and came out looking worried. The boy insisted they bury it.
Wild as the mountains, shouting out in shame.
Grandfather gets upset when Quentin wants to bury one and have a funeral for it. And so that sense that this boy is really overcome by the loneliness that he feels in the town, which is actually something he shares with his grandfather. You know, his grandfather has lost his wife, he's a widower, and his daughter is absent.
It's my mind that still suffers.
In the dark, they held an informal service, burying the animal near the roots of a birch tree the boy seemed to favor.
Our Father.
The boy said a prayer and then covered the animal with two shovelfuls of dirt.
Thy kingdom come.
It occurred to Jim that this was what was wrong with the country, the world today. It was what happened when you stopped seeing things get born and live and then die. It was what happened when a person, when a town, when a whole country didn't have a rudimentary understanding of how things ought to be. So even though they might seem on the surface opposite, they actually have much more in common. And there's also, I think, a strength, whether it's present at first in both characters or not, certainly by the end of the story, both of these characters are really forced to confront their own failings and then challenge themselves to do things they otherwise didn't think they would be able to do.
The light in my mind. Evermore towards the peace I crave. The boundaries I cannot find. Stronger than the wrongs I've made.
You're listening to Arts and Letters.
Speak to me, I'm listening.
We're talking with Joe Mino about his book, Marvel and a Wonder. I kind of like how you open, and it's not every chapter, but it's certain chapters, with notions of place and feelings, color hues. You know, you start with over the low-lying hills, over the wide meadows, the sun rampant, galloping. What are you trying to capture with these lists of places or these moments of feelings that kind of come out in this?
I think the two influences there were two Johns. The first, John Steinbeck, and the way that he uses place as a character in a number of his books. And so he starts his chapters like that. Before you even have characters set on the stage, there's these wonderful, really complicated descriptions of place. And you get all of the conflict of the story through the physical descriptions, completely without character, which is just fascinating. John Ford.
Out here.
and the way in so many of his westerns he used these expository empty landscape shots to set up the tone of the films, the mood of the films, the great expanse of the films that the characters were forced to come up against. And so I was looking at a lot of films like The Searchers to see how much of that film is actually empty space. And you go back and watch and see a lot of those early or mid-century westerns, there are all these shots of just mountains or fields or rivers completely devoid of the characters themselves.
It's all so clear in this wilderness.
So I wanted the book to just feel like it's opening up in the way the characters in the middle of a Western are forced to encounter the vastness of America at that time.
Out here, out here.
What they're encountering is a very different America. It's the America of the late 90s, an America that's fallen on economic recession, a lot of factory jobs have closed, and they're confronting failure of what otherwise, you know, a century and a half before in these Westerns have been portrayed as a world or land of infinite possibilities. They're coming up against the limitations of those possibilities.
Yellow royals everywhere. Screen door.
And you also deal a lot with colors and color hues. So you have white hills, dun-colored hills, green rays, sun-bleached hen houses, painted wood gone vulgar, gray, and then blue light before dawn and blood on the willow. It seems like you're painting pictures.
Yeah, you know, there's definitely a color palette in different sections of the book. So the first book kind of has a blue and white. And, you know, there's a number of photographers that I was looking at or painters. And again, just trying to build the tone or the mood of the story through those really specific images, through really specific kind of color choices. And then those shift from one part of the book to the other, and certainly by the end of the story, as they move into lesser and lesser known locations, farther and farther from home, then that color palette shifts to show that they're encountering or they're entering some unknown place.
There's dirt in my boots, there's hurt in my chest, there's thirst in my room for me to get on back, but not out here.
This world is collapsing on Jim because he can't pay the bills.
He can't pay the bills, and he just doesn't recognize he's working hard. He's doing everything his father did, everything that he was taught to do, and it doesn't matter. He can't keep up. And not only is his farm failing, the other family-owned farms in the town have failed. The town itself has failed. So many of the stores have closed. Industry has left. And so that idea that you could play by the rules, do everything that you could, pay your taxes, and that you should be able to get by, it's no longer a possibility. Mm-hmm. At breakfast, the grandfather glanced from his daughter to his grandson at the kitchen table, looking from one to another. Both his daughter and grandson seemed predestined for failure. Already he had a presentiment, an unconscious belief that the country, the world, was coming to an end. Everything in the fields outside their window seemed to be tilting.
And you also see their distance because Quentin He's in love with exotic reptiles.
And Jim, his escape, is listening to the CB radio.
Yeah, both of them are searching for this thing outside of their kind of physical location. You know, they're both alone. And there's this moment in this opening chapter where Jim, after they finish their chores, he turns on the ham radio and, you know, he's got a map of all the other ham radio operators that he knows. And he does CB. And so these like long distance relationships that have to satisfy the need both of these men have. Quentin has these exotic animals that he, as you know, his great idea is he's going to breed these exotic reptiles as a way to make money, but really it's a way to have a life.
Love how you want to, be what you want to be.
Creates a kind of dim digital town where he searches for his lost mother. He attempts to rescue her, almost like a video game.
In the late 90s, there were these video games where you could play them. And then actually the code was open source, so you could design them, change the characters. And so Quentin has taken one of these video games, which otherwise would have been like a first-person shooter video game, and instead of going around to shoot zombies or Germans from World War II, he's like built this town that's a facsimile of his town, and he just walks around looking for this mother character. Which in a lot of ways definitely relates to Jim and this map of CB operators or ham radios. They have this kind of imaginary landscape that is meant to satisfy their human need for connection, but otherwise it's pretty disappointing.
And I just love your imaginary moments, but to imagine this boy has created this digital town, and instead of having it as a shooter game, he's searching for his mom in the same facsimile of the town that she's nowhere to be found.
I am really there.
Like a deputy sheriff in a ghost town, he would patrol the streets, walking in and out of stores he had created, knowing there'd be no one to trouble him. Somewhere within the dim digital town was his mother. He'd built a character that looked almost exactly like her. Short blonde hair, narrow frame. It was his job to find her and keep her safe, but he could never find her. She was in some secret room he had forgotten how to get into. So on he searched, the pixelated gun held out before him, ready to be fired. And yet knowing there was nothing to shoot.
Come, baby, leave us alone. Yeah, you and me, we go together every day of the week.
He did not know why he did this, why he had built these replica buildings and had not created any enemies to attack, why he had hidden his own mother somewhere in the imitation town, except that marching along the computer version of the same deserted streets gave him a certain kind of loneliness.
This is Arts and Letters. We're talking with author Joe Mino about his novel, Marvel and a Wonder. We'll be back in a moment. This is Arts and Letters. We're talking with writer Joe Mino about his novel, Marvel and a Wonder.
You had the idea of a horse that appears out of the blue. It's a white mare, and it just appears one day. They pull up in a silver trailer, and they say, here's a horse, and it's yours.
Right. Yeah, so this is, you know, set in 1995, so before the efficiency of the digital age, this error happens where Jim and Quentin receive this horse by accident, and all they have to do is sign for it. And as soon as they kind of get this windfall, their life takes this drastic turn and they begin to worry about losing the horse, but then there's also the possibility that they can use the horse to race and win some money to help save the farm.
Give me all the good parts, that's all I want. Give me all the good parts since day one. Give me the good parts you said you have. Give me the good parts you put in my head.
And it also attracts the attention of these two brothers in town who intend to steal it. So it's a big shift in the life of these two characters, otherwise who would remain distant from each other. The horse is the thing that kind of miraculously forces them to change. It forces them to leave the world that they know and forces them to begin to really negotiate each other.
Tell me all the bad things I shouldn't know. Tell me all the bad things you've ever done. Tell me all the bad things we should do.
It's no coincidence, of course, that the mother basically, as she leaves and kind of leaves for good, the horse appears. It's as if the substitute or the thing that they were missing appears in the form of a mare.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. There's so many wonderful Greek, Roman, so many Norse plays about transformations, animals transforming into humans and humans into animals. And so in some ways it's replacing this person who, you know, the mother Deirdre otherwise would have brought these characters together, been a center point for their lives. And when she leaves, or is kind of forced to leave, the horse shows up.
And this isn't just a horse, it's a thoroughbred. I mean, this is a racehorse. This is a horse that could potentially set them free economically.
Right. Jim had been previously staring out the window, felt like the world was ending, and now, whether he wants it or not, here's the appearance of some sort of hope. The white mare appeared on Monday. Neither grandfather nor the grandson had any idea who sent it. At first, there was only the violent agitation of the pickup as it rattled along an unmarked road, towing behind it a fancy silver trailer, all 10 wheels upsetting the air with a cloud of dust high as a steeple. The grandfather raised his hand to his eyes to try to make out the shape of the thing coming. When a man with sunglasses like a state trooper pulled himself out from behind the truck's wheel, stretching his legs from what appeared to have been a long trip, Jim asked him what it was all about.
Give me all the good parts, that's all I want. Give me all the good parts since day one. Give me the good parts you said you have. Give me the good parts you put in my head.
The man had a clipboard and some papers which he asked Jim to sign in triplicate before leading him around to the back of the trailer. There he handed Jim a pink sheet of paper and a pair of silver keys. The horse, sleek looking, even behind steel bars, huffed through its pink nostrils, disappearing back into the darkness.
Tell me all the bad things I shouldn't know. Tell me all the bad things you've ever done.
It's yours.
Mine?
Yours. But
what for?
But there's been some kind of mistake.
No mistake. You Jim Falls?
Yes.
By the way, it's got a name right here.
Then the black pickup was pulling away, was driving off, then was gone. The grandfather studied the animal shape, tried to take in its perfect, imperturbable appearance, and then looking down at the pink paper, it says her name's John the Baptist.
So here we have the prophet, you know, it said Jesus was going to come. John the Baptist is the name of the horse. Why was the horse called John the Baptist?
So much of the book is about sacrifice. And, you know, the way I recall John the Baptist, I recall his end and sacrifice by Salome. And so that name is meant to conjure up the possibility of some great sacrifice that might be coming this family's way in the future.
Right. He's not a big character in the book, but he's an important character, Rodrigo, the hired hand. He says, John, for a lady?
For sure. So Rodrigo's the only one who has any experience with horses on the farm. And, you know, even though Jim recognizes it's a racehorse, he's never ridden a horse before, and Quentin has no relationship to horses. Rodrigo had worked on a horse farm before, and so he actually knows how to ride. And so they're really dependent on him and his knowledge in order to utilize or get a sense of the possibility of what this horse can do for them.
Dizzy in disaster, I'm a train stuck in reverse.
It felt like the horse was the answer to something. He had an ache just then, not in his joints, nor in his stomach, nor in his liver. And he remembered the place where he had been struck one afternoon when catching sight of the back of his wife Dee Dee's knees as she stood on the chair and reached to retrieve a box from the top shelf of the school supply closet where she was teaching.
I still hear all the laughter of the devils outside my hurts. I want to live my truth, no more floods to wash away what's real. Don't make me walk away from myself with mud on my boot heels.
Do we get to keep it?
I don't know. We'll see.
In this moment, when he sees the horse, Jim is struck by this reminiscence of seeing his wife when they were younger standing up on a chair and seeing something about her ankle and the feminine qualities of this horse and the sense of hope and future and just the remembrance of beauty.
Right.
And then, you know, as he's gotten older, that's become something he's forgotten, that you can still be struck by beauty.
They say the tortoise and the hare is a story to be studied. I've refused to become aware of hard work over feeling lucky. But I've seen the truth, no more floods washing away what's real. Don't make me walk away from myself with mud on my boot heels.
At least at this point, the way that you had set it up with the dead chick and the mother who leaves and the wandering through the digital town. For me, when the horse appears, I say, uh-oh.
Yeah, it's just like any miracle. It brings this sense of change, which presents a lot of opportunities, and then everything comes at a cost. You know, anything worth its weight is something you have to pay for in some ways. In the middle of the book, him and Quentin have this conversation about, where did you think this horse came from? And he's embarrassed to admit that he really believes his wife, even though she's passed away for, you know, a number of years, that somehow she's responsible, that she somehow sent this horse to them to help them. And so when he sees that horse and remembers her ankle and thinks about the last time he saw something beautiful, it's definitely meant to connect the horse to the memory of the last beautiful thing in his life.
Well said. And then, of course, we have this quintessential moment of the next day. This happens,
right.
And now we embark on the archetypal quest with this new character.
Approaching the silver trailer the next day, both the grandfather and the boy tried to catch a glimpse of the animal asleep inside, but it was already awake, poking its great pink nostrils through the metal slats. The boy held out his hand and felt its breath, humid, so much like a human's. It was a marvel. The grandfather watched the boy and pondered what they'd done to deserve such a thing.
Hello. 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 I am your friend.
The road has worn me down, running on fumes and adrenaline. The miles have lost their shine.
The boy and his grandfather made their way to town. From behind the dashboard of the blue pickup, the nearby fields looked fearsome, zigzagging with bayonets or rippling corn.
Now I know the truth. It's in my blood, running strong as steel. Ain't walking away from myself with mud on my boot heel. No, I'd never walk away from myself with mud on my boot heel.
And so they set off to meet another Jim, Northfield, who is kind of the opposite of Jim. He's a lawyer. And they set off to kind of do the right thing. Jim, the grandfather, sets off to see what's going on. I mean, is this really true? Do I need to give it back? And I love that moral compass of the grandfather. It seems like he finds it here, although, you know, we're bothered a little bit by some of his comments early on. He does try to do the right thing, doesn't he?
Right. Yeah, no, definitely. I feel like he is a moral character. He's trying to do the right thing. Unfortunately, his idea of the right thing might be hopelessly outdated in some ways. And so in this case, it's definitely, you know, he got this thing, this horse showed up, and he doesn't deserve it, he feels like. They didn't do anything, it's been a mistake. So he wants to legally try to follow through and return it to the owner. If he does the right thing, he'll maybe get to keep this horse. And if he can keep this horse, then there's some hope that the farm won't be taken over and that something can happen that will change his life.
Well, I finally drew a pony that I know I can ride to start craving crazy and out of my mind.
Let's move through the signs and signals and signposts as we venture out of the little town and into a grander world.
Interstate 65, Interstate 69, Interstate 64, Interstate 70, Interstate 74.
Route 6, Route 20, Route 24, Route 27, Mulberry, Zionsville, Brownsburg, Mount Holly.
But I couldn't change if I wanted, with the exception of you. It's all that I love and know how to do.
Over the past two decades, Mount Holly had become a ghost town. All these store facades looked ghostly, a picture postcard twin that had seen better days 50 years before. The glassy windows desolate, unmarred save for the reflection of the pale blue pickup truck that was pulling into a parking spot alongside the boarded up cafe.
So Quentin and his grandfather, they take the trip to town to talk to Judge Northfield.
Jim Northfield was a gray-haired gentleman with bushy eyebrows who no longer practiced law, but who was kind enough to look over the receipts and bill declaring the transfer of property.
Well, what have you gotten yourself into? I didn't know you owned any horses.
I don't, which is why we've come to see you.
Don't pin your hopes on me. I lost the last three cases I had. It's the reason I became a judge.
He eyed the wide-faced boy and then nodded at the jar of moth-eaten lollipops on the corner of his desk.
Help yourself.
I'm not supposed to eat sweets.
Never mind him. Here we go now.
Jim Northfield opened the jar, and the boy took out a yellow one. Then he slipped the boy a tattered-looking business card.
If you ever need a good lawyer. Old habits. Now, how did this horse show up?
We were counting chicks yesterday when this truck pulled in, towing a trailer. The man asked my name and address and then handed me the keys. Then he gave me that sheet of paper.
It's all here. Horse, trailer, saddle, bridle. There's your name and address, and that's all correct?
Yes.
As far as I'm concerned, the animal's yours.
Ours?
That is, unless someone brings forth a suit.
A suit?
Claiming it's theirs. But you got the transfer of the property, and better than that, the horse itself. You know the old saying, possession's 9/10 of the law.
So that's it?
For now. Let me get the phone number of the delivery company back east. Confidentially, if it was me, I'd hope I'd have the good sense to keep my mouth shut, count my blessings, and try not to court trouble.
That's exactly what we aim to do.
But I won't take a taxi or jump an old freight train. Start my truck, wear out my boots, I book on an airplane, but on a horse of a different color, I can saddle up and ride, start craving crazy and out of my mind.
And then, not long after, the grandfather, Jim, gets a call from a New York lawyer.
Jim said goodbye.
Goodbye.
And set the phone back on the wall, holding his hand against the cool plastic device, waiting for it to begin to ring again to tell him it was all a joke, but it did not. He thought maybe the conversation had taken place inside some childhood dream. The fields gone purple, a girl with an apple for a face, a tea kettle that could speak. He stood there in the kitchen with his hand on the phone.
So the lawyer tells him, hey, it looks like the horse is yours. We can't tell you who it's from. We can't tell you anything about it. There may be a lawsuit. It seems like people are contesting it, but for now, it's yours.
In the dark later that same night, the grandfather crept out alone to the stable and put a hand on the mare's neck.
What if?
He began to think, looking into its blue-black eyes, measuring the gentle slope of its shoulder, feeling its breath on the palm of his other hand.
What if? What if it really is ours?
Here's a story.
What if we were to race it?
In that face.
What if?
There's a face.
What if it really is ours?
In the story.
What if this might be the thing?
Abrasions from occasions that I pray.
The one thing that saved us.
Someone else's glory.
When it moved,
there's a truth.
It seemed to be absent of any color at all.
To be here.
Only a flash, like a zipper of lightning.
There's a holding in the truth.
A pulse of absolute blindness.
It's still conditional.
Mm.
There's nothing more terrifying than hope.
You are free. From yourself.
You know, there's nothing more terrifying than the sense that things might change for the better and then to come and find out that that's not the case.
You are free from yourself. There's a happiness that hides. There's hiding in the happiness. I believe
questions about life would make their answers
in the time
apparent all too soon.
That kept me from heartless.
Later, they led the horse from the trailer to watch it run. The sun was just beginning to set. The grandfather stared at the animal's gray muzzle and gray eyelids and gray ears, the pale gray mane, everything else sleek and muscled and altogether colorless.
It was sort of like watching your own death, but beautiful too. Something so mysterious and fulsome.
And this is a little bit about half forgotten, half remembered, the possibility of dream, isn't it?
I think it's easy for us to feel comfortable in tragedy or feel jaded, to feel like regardless of our age, we have the answers that we need. And for Jim, as he's approaching the end of his life, that sense that the unknown is really terrifying. And for Quentin, the sense of the unknown and the sense of the uncertain is also terrifying as well. And so both of these men have to encounter what's terrifying and find a way to move past that.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to actors Jim Metzger, William Wagner, Roger Glasgow, and Tyrone Whitmore as Quentin. Thank you to musicians and songwriters Cook.
They plucked me straight from the dirt, took me from the place of my birth. Me and my mom were separated and cursed.
Harry Blanton.
Well, I finally drew a pony that I know I can ride.
Michael and Ashley Shackelford and their band, Galactic Engineers of Magnetic Sound. And a special thanks to the beautiful and talented Grace Askew for the amazing songs. Thank you to Barb Anguiano for helping to record the program. Thank you to Adam Simon for mastering the program. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer Joe Mino for this intergenerational and interracial quest in which Jim and Quentin wonder how they might rescue each other from the wilderness and marvel at their potential future together. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of filmmaker John Ford. You can speak well if your tongue can deliver the message of your heart.